It's almost time, kids. The clock is ticking. Be in front of your TV sets for the horror-a-thon.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way. It's the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies, but not in a creepy way. Welcome, this is Eric.
Is it true?
And tonight we're going to talk about the 1982 masterpiece, John Carpenter's The Thing. I think we had talked before, but we might as well mention that at least the way I was introduced to this movie was probably on some version of cable, although we didn't have cable at our house. Maybe in a Cousin Joe kind of movie. And I know we rented it a lot.
Yeah, that's my memory of The Thing, is watching it in our downstairs on a giant console TV in the dark.
Oh, of course.
In the middle of winter in Alaska.
When you were far too young.
Far too young. Although I do have a bit of a special relationship with this movie, because I think this was the first horror movie where I actually got it and enjoyed it as a movie, not just as a sort of freak show that I endured just so I could hang out with my older siblings and extended family.
Well, excellent. Well, it's a pretty simple story, really.
Yeah, it's very easy to follow, but well done. And the more complicated scenes, like the blood test. Even if I think I had to have you explain that to me, but even that was simple enough that if I didn't get it from the movie, I got it pretty readily from your explanation.
Yeah, and it's. I mean, looking back at it, it's been copied so many times, not just by the 2011, 2010 prequel that I thought was kind of unnecessary.
Yeah, that seems like just a good idea gone bad.
Yeah, I had heard somewhere along the line, I don't know whether it's true or not, that the prequel was just supposed to be a straight-up remake, which makes a lot of sense considering they steal a lot from this movie, which is in itself a remake of a movie from the 50s. What is it? Howard Hawks movie?
Yeah, I've never seen any other version of the story.
I would,
or read any of the source material.
Well, I would recommend. Well, the original source was Joseph W. Campbell's Who Goes There, a short story written in the 50s. And then the screenplay was actually written by, for this movie, it was written by Bill Lancaster, happens to be the son of Burt Lancaster. That's simple trivia. But I would recommend the Howard Hawks movie. It's a different kind of thing. It's fun because some of it takes place in Anchorage, although it was all, I'm sure, a soundstage. But it's basically the same story, except that when they describe the thing, they literally say it's a carrot. It's a carrot from space.
Carrot?
Yeah, it's a vegetable, but they literally pinpoint it to carrot.
That's great.
But everything else is the same. The only thing that was different, and I'm pretty sure the Joseph Campbell and the Howard Hawks movie, it was the Americans that found the spaceship and then accidentally blew it up with thermite, and the only thing left was basically the thing. You know, this has the addition of the Norwegian camp, which I think is actually pretty brilliant.
Yeah, the world that John Carpenter created for this is so well done that I can see how the pitch went when they decided to make it a prequel. you know, let's go back and let's take a look at what happened in the Norwegian camp. That on the surface could be really interesting if done well.
Oh yeah, and she could have just dovetailed where the last scene was just the Norwegians going after the dog, which I think is what they tried to do. But I don't know. I mean, I watched it when it came out, and I owned it. I went and bought it, which was sort of silly in hindsight. But you win some, you lose some. And I will at some time revisit it. But it was so much fun to go back and watch this. This is just a fun movie for me.
Yeah, I had a similar experience. I DVR'd it when it first hit the movie channels, and ended up watching it that way. But I didn't have nearly as good a time as I did rewatching the original for this discussion.
Yeah. So are we going to get into the plot of the movie or anything else before we dive into the movie itself?
No, let's dive.
Okay. The opening. It's space. And there's a flying saucer that crashes into the Earth, Antarctica particularly. And then you have, I think, it just a recreation of the Howard Hawks title sequence. But if I remember correctly, they basically filled a fish tank full of smoke and had the thing title all on the glass and then put a black garbage bag in front of it and set the garbage bag on fire. And that's how they got the effect of the titles, which is pretty great.
How very industrious.
Yeah. It starts out, this actually is not scored by John Carpenter. I think it's the first of his movies that's not his own score. But it still starts out with kind of a John Carpenter type score where they have basically just the bass and maybe a little bit of drums to sort of set the scene.
Yeah, it's good. It's sort of filling you with unintended or intended unrealized sense of dread right away.
Yeah. And you've got this whole vista of the frozen, I think it's British Columbia they're shooting at. Or some places I think they're shooting in the Juneau area of Alaska too. But either they built the town or they took over like an abandoned bunch of buildings in BC where they did a lot of the shooting. So this is all like real cold stuff for the most part. And the way they take this movie, one of the things that impresses me about this movie is it's telling a pretty simple story, but it's keeping the action in a very small stage. I mean, it's got the story itself, because you start out with the flying saucer hitting the Earth. That makes it a huge kind of huge scope. Could be, you know, you could go anywhere with that. But they narrow it down to basically like, 10 guys in this little camp, and it just gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And it's perfect.
Yeah, the flying saucer in outer space is so incidental that I didn't even remember it.
Well, yeah, because you don't even need to know necessarily where this thing came from. I think I like the idea of whoever finds the saucer tries to thaw it with thermite. That's the whole point, is they tried to thaw the ice around it so they could get at it, but unintentionally, because they don't know what the material is, they set it all on fire, and so they burn up all their evidence. This movie actually has the craft itself is still there. But anyway, so all you see is this dog. It's like a Malamute wolf hybrid thing running across the snow, and it's being chased by this Norwegian helicopter. And the Norwegians are shooting at the dog and trying to drop these thermite charges because of grenade things. And they're coming closer and closer to the American camp. By the way, I don't think anywhere... It's just like a generic research camp, right? We don't even know what their objectives are. That's never really explained. Is that about right?
Guessing what they're doing out there.
Yeah. I mean, they've got all the elements of, you know, they have a biologist and a meteorologist and a couple of pilots and all these scientist kind of people, but they don't really explain why they're there, other than general research, which, again, is just fine. So the first thing you see is this dog coming into camp, and you meet some of the guys in the crew, I guess, what you call it, in the facility. And I love the fact that these are all scruffy looking guys. They all look like slope workers, you know.
Yeah, it's funny. The first time I watched it, I've grown up and become a productive member of the workforce, and in doing so, for my previous job, I actually spent a lot of time in camps in remote parts of Alaska, and one in particular was on the North Slope in winter, in a camp away from any of the oil field activities. So I have a much greater appreciation now for the setting than I did when I was a little kid. And they got so many things right. Just how scruffy they were at the camp, you know, when not only are you probably trying to conserve water, at some point when all you're doing is working with a bunch of guys who you probably didn't know all that well before you went out there, you know, maintaining the highest levels of hygiene isn't really your priority. And then the downtime, they had a few scenes of them just kind of hanging out and killing time, either after hours or when they couldn't work due to weather. And that they really did a good job of just nailing that dynamic when you're just trying to do anything to pass the time, waiting for the next meal, which is sort of how you mark the passage of time, is, you know, dinner or breakfast or lunch, whatever. You know, so they're playing pool, they're playing poker, MacReady is playing chess with a very ancient looking computer chess game.
Yeah,
Void didn't ring true. No matter how drunk he was, there's no way he would have destroyed that, because that's just entertainment that you're missing out on.
Well, exactly. Yeah, you wouldn't. And it, I mean, other than the fact it was Adrian Barbeau's voice, who is, by the way, married to John Carpenter at the time, and is the only female on the entire movie.
Right.
But yeah, you wouldn't. You're right. You wouldn't dump your drink into that. Also, it's wasting your drink too.
They seem to have plenty of booze.
Yeah. True. So. You meet them kind of, you know, doing their thing again, just sort of not doing much. I think some guys are playing ping pong, maybe, including a surprisingly young and unbearded Wilford Brimley. But the dog run.
He was still old.
Well, it's true. He was old, yeah. But younger than I remember him from. What did I remember him from?
Our house.
But actually, what? Cocoon and oatmeal commercials. And later diabetes supplies. But anyway, so the dog comes into camp and it pursued by these, the Norwegians who are shooting at it. They land their helicopter. They take a shot at the dog and actually end up hitting one of the members of the crew, who's actually the meteorologist, Bennings, who is in, by the way, his name is Peter Maloney, and he was in Thinner and Manhunter, among other things. So, the commander, the station commander, is played by Donald Moffat, Commander Gary, who, by the way, he has eyebrows for days. Love him. He was in One Life to Live and Clear and Present Danger, actually. It's his biggest IMDb credits. But he ends up pulling the pistol off his hip and shooting the Norwegian that is left, because the other guy tried to take a thermite charge and throw it at the dog and ended up dropping it near the helicopter and blew up their helicopter and himself. So this is a pretty dramatic beginning. And of course, MacReady, who is Kurt Russell, his first comment about the whole thing is, it's the first goddamn week of winter. So again, it's making the stage very small, right, and isolated. You know, it's the beginning of winter. Pretty soon we figure out there's a storm coming. They are just stuck out in the middle of nowhere. Oh, and we meet right away Windows, the radio operator, who he can't get any signals from anybody. So they're cut off.
And who played Windows? Did you recognize him from any place else?
I did not recognize him, although he, let me see here.
He looked really familiar to me, and I just pictured him getting beat up by cops.
Well, his name is Thomas G. Waits, and he's been on a lot of TV and some movies, but he's primarily a stage actor, and he actually runs an actor studio in New York when he's not actually doing acting gigs.
All right.
Yeah, so I didn't see any credits that jumped off the page at me, but I thought he looked a little bit like Jason Patrick.
In his super dirty role?
Yeah, with a lot of, you know, facial hair and a fro. But this is where we're first introduced to MacReady, who's the hero of our little tale, Kurt Russell, where he's playing chess against the computer and believes the computer's cheating. And he's a helicopter pilot. And he has the best hat ever. I mean, I know we gushed a lot about Kurt Russell's mustache in Tombstone, absolutely appropriately. But I think if there's going to be an inanimate object that that steals this whole movie, it's Kurt Russell's hat.
And he doesn't wear it very long. It's just a brief appearance, but he rocks the hell out of that thing.
Well, he wears it. It's just on his back most of the time. Like throughout the whole second half of the movie, he's got it on. It just happens to be, you know, you only see it when you see his back. And it is like a leather sombrero.
Yes, by the way, our deal still stands, but you cannot wear it on your back.
Okay. Yeah, I had,
must be worn on your head.
Yeah, earlier in the day, I had texted Drew that I had found this hat or a replica of this hat available. And because I was looking to see what the hell kind of hat this was. It turns out if you look up, if you just Google MacReady's hat, you get a whole bunch of different things. But it's got a 4-dent military 6-inch crown and a hand-shaped 5-inch brim, by the way. And it's, you know, it's a handmade leather hat. So it's serious, or felt hat, actually. So it's pretty serious. And it's like for the cheapest version that's just miscellaneous felt, it's like almost $400. And for the 100% beaver felt edition, you could spend $700 or $800 easily. And Drew suggested that if I wore it as my daily hat, he would buy the cheaper version for me. And there's no way. There's absolutely no way.
I absolutely would.
It's such a gigantic hat. Anyway. I was just impressed by the hat. You got to be a certain kind of dude to wear a hat like that. I think you have to rock the whole big beard, too, with it.
I want you to walk into the police station wearing that hat.
we'll see. If I can find some sort of something similar, maybe, but there's no way I would be investing $400 in a hat that would be a stunt hat. I'm not even sure I approve of hats, just generally.
But, you could make an exception.
anyway, so yeah, so we got Kurt Russell and his hat. And then, so basically, they want to find out what the hell those crazy Swedes are doing, which they keep suggesting, they keep telling MacReady that they're really Norwegians, not Swedes, but still, it's sort of funny. So we have MacReady and Dr. Copper, who's Richard Dysart. And he was in L.A. Law, is his most notable role. But he was also in Back to the Future 3, I guess. And they...
I don't remember anything about Back to the Future 3 except for a flying train.
Yeah, I remember the train as well. But what can you do? So they go to the Norwegian camp to find out what the hell's up with the crazy Swedes. And they discover that their whole camp is a charred ruin.
Yeah, before we get there, even if you think the crazy Swedes, Norwegians, were indeed out of their mind trying to kill that dog, wouldn't you still worry a little bit about the dog? I mean, you wouldn't suspect that the dog is an alien creature who is about to kill everybody in camp, but maybe you might be concerned about something as rudimentary as rabies.
Well, yeah, you'd think, which is why
they just welcomed the dog with open arms. And it was like, oh, come here, buddy. Come roam around our camp unchecked.
Well, yeah. And later, when they do lock up the dog with the rest of the dogs and it goes poorly, they asked Richard Masseur. He was a one day at a time and 128 other things, by the way. He's a dog handler. And when that goes awry, they're like, this is the first time you put that dog in the kennel? What's he been doing all the time? It's like, oh, just roaming around the camp, looking around. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. But, yeah, so I guess the dog is back at the camp roaming around while Copper and MacReady are over at the Norwegian camp. And they find some crazy stuff there, including, I don't know, a flying saucer and a big... hole in the ice, and then inside the camp they find a sort of a ice sarcophagus that's empty, and they also find the burned remains of a humanoid corpse with two faces. This is all from Wikipedia, by the way, which they bring back with them. This is our first look at Rob Bottin's sculptures in this movie, and
yeah, it looked like maybe a bunch of people were all melted together.
Exactly. It looks like there's the faces in particular. There's two distinct faces that look like they were either dividing into two faces from one, or they were two faces that were melted together trying to get apart.
Yeah, whatever it was. It was a very, very chilling discovery.
Oh, and it's so, the sculptures are so disturbing and fun. I mean, that's the best part of this movie, is that although some of the special effects are kind of goofy, just looking at like the static sculptures, I'm sure it must have been creepy on the set. But
indeed.
But yeah, so they bring a bunch of videotapes and papers back with this corpse thing, so that the biologist Blair, Wilford Brimley, can perform an autopsy on. And he finds a normal set of human internal organs. So at this point, I believe, we have the dog handler Clark, who's Richard Masseur, decides to kennel the new dog, with all the sled dogs. And that's the first time we see the thing actually metamorphosize. That's the right word. It transforms. And it's pretty great.
I don't know that it transforms so much as it opens up and unleashes horror.
Yeah, it's got really like a Lovecraft element because of all the little tentacles and stuff. And it's the sounds they use for the transformation, you know, all the whipping of the tentacle things, and then all like the insect sounds. Just creepy. And then, of course, like, you know, the head, there are a couple times where heads just open up like a flower.
Right.
And that must have been fun for them to do, because they do it a couple of times to great effect.
Yeah, and it's a little bit different every time, but it is just a great monster movie moment.
Oh, and the fact that they're using so many different things. They're using, you know, all these practical effects. They've got puppetry going on, and they have like animatronic things happening. I mean, I'd forgotten the part where, to get back to one thing, some of the little touches, I thought, things like the one dog trying to chew its way out of the chain link fence. That was great.
That was so sad. But yeah, nothing like, there are two things about this first alien scene that really struck me. One was that it came pretty early in the movie. I think most of the time you would expect the movie to draw it out a little longer, make the tension a little bit greater. But this was pretty early on when they just go right for it.
Oh yeah.
The other is to the other thing that struck me is it how much it sort of simultaneously subverts your natural inclination to want to like the cute fuzzy animal by having it transformed into a horrible monster. But then it also capitalizes on that by having the horrible monster kill a bunch of the other dogs. So, there's no doubt in your mind at this point that, this isn't just an alien creature, you know, struggling for survival. It killed a bunch of helpless dogs, so there's no way you're going to feel any sympathy for it.
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, it turns out this movie was not a hit when it came out, and we'll talk about that at the end, I think. But one of the things that probably didn't help it was that it came out at the same time as E.T. So if you were going to an Alien Visits the Earth sci-fi movie, and expecting anything like E.T., you were going to be horribly disappointed as well as actually horrified.
Oh, that's... I can't... This came out at the same time as E.T.?
Yes. Or maybe it was slightly after, but it was directly in reviews at the time. It was directly compared to E.T.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah.
This is a much better movie than E.T.
You know, I haven't seen E.T. since the time, but I've heard it actually doesn't hold up all that well. No, this was, again, I love this movie, so I'm totally biased toward this. And I saw E.T. I thought E.T. was fine at the time, but I don't think they're not in the same category. I mean, other than both being films.
Right. They are both films.
Yeah, that's all we can do to compare them. So anyway.
I concur with that statement.
Out on a limb. Again, that's a trademark of our podcast, is going out on limbs to take hard stands. So after the first, well, first of all, we have a little bit of gore to begin with the first autopsy. And then we have the transformation scene, which is gory and horrifying and scary. And I thought, you know, again, I don't have any direct experience with being a camp out in the middle of nowhere, but maybe setting off a flamethrower inside your structure is kind of a bold move, at least.
Yeah, they did a few things. The first one that really caught me was when I forget his name, Eyebrows Dude, broke out a window so he could shoot the Norwegian guy.
Yeah,
that's just a bad idea in the Antarctic winter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Commander Gary was not thinking when he broke out that window. Especially since it seems like he could have just run around the corner. It wasn't like he was on a fourth floor apartment.
He could have maybe opened a door. It would have been fine.
Yeah, exactly.
But what I did appreciate, they never took the flamethrower anywhere inside without also having a couple guys with fire extinguishers nearby.
It looks like they actually had practiced the flamethrower drill before.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know why you would have a flamethrower at a research facility.
Yeah, or two, you have a backup flamethrower.
Yeah, I don't know what you use a flamethrower for except for killing things.
Yeah, well, and apparently, and again, this is just something I heard on another podcast. I think it was like maybe one of the How Stuff Works podcasts, that back in the days when they used flamethrowers like for war purposes, the guy who was the whatever you would call him, he was pretty much, he might as well have been a bomb engineer as far as he had a low likelihood of coming home. Because, you know, what do? You shoot the guy with the flamethrower, and guess what? You shoot him and he blows up because he's basically carrying around tanks of gas on his back.
Right.
Yeah, so anyway. Yeah, but, you know, it works in this sense, so it's just fine. And again, these are guys who just, you know, they're not going to mess around. They're just going to go with whatever they can. So now we have, Clark, the dog handler, you know, sees the first transformation, and MacReady hears it and pulls the fire alarm, and everybody runs in. Then Childs, played by the incredible Keith David. By the way, Keith David has 230 acting credits. He's been in everything.
He's married. He's Mary's dad.
Mary's dad.
Something about Mary.
Oh, I didn't even know that. He's was in Platoon, Pitch Black, Crash, and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And he has the best voice in the world. Or one of them. Anyway, he comes running in. By the way, the other black guy, Knowles,
is pretty great too. Did he also have a really small part in Roadhouse?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe. I caught the last half of Roadhouse the other day.
I think he was like a bartender for a second.
It would not, again, 230 acting credits. Probably the most acting credits I've seen at all on IMDb so far. But anyway, so Childs comes in with the flamethrower. Because, you know, of course they say, hey, Childs, get the flamethrower. And he's like, okay. So again, they practiced this flamethrower drill before. So they incinerate the creature. Well, what is it? Half of it runs up into the ceiling? Or did it come down on the ceiling?
It went up in the ceiling.
Okay, yeah. So there were several dogs and the creature all involved at this point. So it was a pretty chaotic scene.
What I really liked about it was after they incinerated the creature and then they put the fire out. There was a really genuine moment there where they were just kind of standing around with the what the shit look on their face. You know, nobody really knew what to do next.
I thought the chemistry between these guys was pretty great. You know, it seems like they all had just enough backstory. That's the other thing this movie is criticized for, is not having enough heart, enough character development. But I thought they had just enough character development to get you going and not any more to drag the pace down.
No, I agree. I mean, this isn't a movie about character growth. This is a movie about surviving a horrible alien.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, your best bet for character growth is to survive past the end credits. So, after they've burned this at least part of this thing, they take it back to do another autopsy now, or necropsy, or whatever you thingtopsy, whatever. That's when Blair. You must admit that Blair, the biologist, Wilford Brimley guy, not only is he one of the smartest characters I've ever seen in any movies, but he has a computer that is magic.
Yeah, that's some high level and very specific modeling for such a ancient desktop computer.
Well, it's so beautiful because it basically, he has a hypothesis pretty much right away that this thing is transforming into other creatures. It's imitating on a cellular level other creatures. And he ends up going to his computer where, yeah, there's this very crude graphics, but then, yeah, very specific information. It's like, you know. How long it would take if this thing gets out of this confined space, if it reaches civilization, how long would it take to destroy the Earth? And it comes with an answer in a certain amount of hours. It's like, that is as specific as it gets. I mean, you might as well just type in, what is this? And it would come out with, you know, pages and pages of answer.
Yeah. What I really, really appreciated about the scene is how it looked like, somebody was sitting at our old Bosses 108 computer just typing while somebody filmed the screen.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. While Blair is dealing with this, they're looking at the Norwegian's video, and this is actually where they find out about the flying saucer. And I'm sorry, it was actually when they go back that they see the flying saucer. But at this point, now you have a drama between the characters too, because now that we know this thing can change shapes and transform into what looks like other creatures, now nobody is safe. Now you suspect everybody.
Yeah, everybody's trying to do the forensics about who would have been alone with the dog long enough for it to have killed them and then assume their shape.
Yes, and there are plenty of times in this little tale that the people have to or happen to get separated from one another. So it's a little bit of a whodunit.
Yeah, there's a really good mystery aspect to this movie that really kept it humming along. You know, this wasn't just a slasher movie where the evil creature was picking them off one by one. There's some genuine tension associated with just trying to figure things out.
You know, I think they did a good job, especially with like Blair, of, you know, he's now suspicious of everybody and withdraws from the whole group. And, he has definite opinions and he's not one of the team anymore. He's like, this thing is going to kill everybody. So we have to get rid of it in an ultimate kind of way. But the other biologist, Fuchs, who's played by Joel Polis, who I didn't see anything about, talks about how he's worried about Blair because he's been looking at Blair's journals. And they're saying that the creature's dead remains still are active on a cellular level. So they decide to burn all the bodies to reduce the risk of infection. And so the creature assimilates the meteorologist guy who got shot in the very beginning. And I thought this was very effective. He doesn't quite get transformed into him because they catch up with him, Windows specifically, actually. And then MacReady burns him before he can escape. But he had like these claw hand things, which I thought was, you know, a very effective effect, if you will.
Right. He just hadn't quite completed the transformation.
So I thought that was beautiful. By the way, it's worth pointing out that in the original script, the character Windows was originally named Sanchez, and he was described as hating it and lousy at his job.
Oh, no.
So thumbs up for whoever decided to take the racism out of the movie.
Yeah, and you've got Childs playing, probably a second banana to Kurt Russell's protagonist character.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty progressive for 1982.
Sure. And, you know, Knowles, who's the other black guy, played by T.K. Carter, who's a stand-up comedian and former child actor. Granted, he's got a little bit of the 70s, 80s stink about him, his character, because he's roller skating, of course, and he's wearing a headband. And he's always juking around.
I'm listening to Stevie Wonder.
Mm-hmm. Which, by the way,
that's all that black people listen to in the 80s.
Well, I thought it was just Superstition is a fantastic song in this movie. It just yes, works.
It was well played.
Yeah. But he also keeps referring to the meteorologist as Buona, which I thought was sort of, again, sort of 70s, 80s sort of thing. So this is where Blair loses his shit, decides he's going to prevent this thing from escaping. Or actually, he's not really, I mean, he is losing his shit, but it seems a pretty sound plan. He's just going to kill everybody to make sure that it happens, because he destroys the helicopter, and he's destroying all the computers and radio equipment, and he's gonna trash everything.
Yeah, he was doing his best to make sure that nobody made it out of that camp alive. Although he didn't seem to take into account that this creature had been frozen in the ice for maybe hundreds of thousands of years and was still able to come back to life pretty readily.
Yeah, later in the movie they address that. But yeah, you're right, at the beginning. Although in the scene where he is basically, Windows is cowering in the corner while Blair is taking like an axe to everything, and at one point they try to grab, or I guess maybe do it a Childs? Yeah, right, it was Childs who was trying to maybe sneak up behind him, and Blair takes out a gun and starts shooting.
Right.
What I think is always a boss move is firing your gun until you run out of ammo and then throwing the gun.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't get any more manly than that.
Nope, until someone runs at you with a table.
It's true. It's not a bad plan, really.
Oh, it's a great plan, but that's even more manly than throwing a gun. It's just picking up a table and charging somebody.
Well, because as now we know, because we live in the future too, but in the paper, scissors, rock world, table beats axe.
As it turns out.
Yeah. So Dr. Copper after they've grabbed Blair and locked him in a shed, Dr. Copper recommends a blood serum test to determine, you know, who's infected and who's not. So they're going to go to the blood supplies and check everybody's blood. But of course, at that point, they find out that the blood supplies have been sabotaged because there's only two people that have the keys to the blood, and that is Copper, I believe, and then also Commander Gary. All of a sudden, Gary's under suspicion of maybe being a thing himself. So that's where MacReady takes over. Basically, he's just his force of will just takes right over. And he orders Fuchs to continue Blair's work, but Fuchs disappears. Again, one of the many times people in this movie sort of disappear, so now they become a suspect.
Which, by the way, totally happens in camps. That's the real thing. I mean, you spend so much time around these people because you're working with them and you're living with them and in a really cramped environment that, people just go for walks just to get some solitude.
Well, yeah, that makes sense. Anyway, so they end up finding Fuchs's body outside, all burned up. So this is where people start to turn on each other.
Yeah, because they couldn't tell if it was a self-immolation or if he had been attacked by the creature, and none of it made sense.
So they start to investigate, and Knowles and MacReady are out together, and apparently Knowles had found a torn shirt with MacReady's name on it. So he decides this would be a good time during the storm to just cut him loose from this line they have together and just strand him out in the cold till he dies. Which, again, we don't know. He hasn't thought through this whole freezing thing. But it's if MacReady's not the thing, it's a cold move. No pun intended.
Yeah, that's actually really, really terrifying. They have these tethers between all the buildings so that... And that's a pretty standard thing in deep winter environments, so that if you're caught outside during a really bad storm and you can't see, you can still follow the rope line back to the next building. And they're having one of these storms, and Knowles cuts the line so that MacReady can't follow it back to the main building.
You're talking about a snowstorm where you can't see. There's no visibility at all. But because we're talking about snow in the air and also snow on the ground, it's not like you just don't have your compass directions. You don't have any direction. Now, you don't even know.
Right.
You can't even tell which way is up in a situation like this. So being stranded out there in the middle of nowhere is not a happy place. But luckily, he finds his way back, and he's not happy about being cut loose.
Yeah, in the interim, while he was out searching for a way back, he managed to wrap himself with dynamite.
Yeah, and he carries this bundle of dynamite with him for the rest of the movie, pretty much. And he's kind of, it seems like he's pretty nonchalant about how this dynamite is very, very close to, a flamethrower or some other source of ignition.
Well, he's got some... detective rigs in him throughout the whole movie. Yeah, again, we don't get any backstory, but he seems not afraid to die. I mean, even in the very beginning when they want to go visit the Norwegian camp, the weather's pretty sketchy, and you could tell he doesn't think it's a good idea to go. But when they say it's your call, he's like, all right, fuck it, let's go.
What did he say? You have to read the map because I'll be busy?
Right.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because the other pilot, Palmer, who he has a lot of, he has 124 acting credits, including 30-something, and then the Gone Girl he's in. But he's the guy in the biker gang vest and smoking dope all the time. You know, he seems like the least trustworthy pilot in the whole world, really.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, there's no doubt why you'd want MacReady to be the pilot of choice. By the way, Palmer, though, he is one of the best lines in the entire movie, though, in just a second. So MacReady comes in with his dynamite, and he is like, okay, now we're not fucking around. I will destroy this whole station if you attack me. And during this little the conflict between them, Norris ends up having a heart attack. So they drag him into the, what is it, like, I guess the...
It's a sick bay.
And he's on a gurney, and they do. I thought of you when the doctor rips off his shirt and gives him one big thump on the chest to start his CPR, which again
it usually works. I don't know what happens.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, nothing else. It feels good. It's like, God damn you. So then he starts actual chest compressions, and then they get a defibrillator, a for real defibrillator instead of the automatic type. And I guess you should be expecting this sort of thing to happen, but I thought it was quite effective when he does the second of the shocks, I think, and the guy's chest opens up like a mouth and chomps down and bites the arms off of the doctor.
Oh, that's a great scene. There's no way you're expecting that.
Yeah, and so
why would the thing fake a heart attack?
Yeah, and let himself be shocked once, right? And that second shock.
That was at least the third or fourth shock.
Oh, maybe, yeah. Yeah, that's intense stuff. So, yeah. And then I love this scene because even though it has probably the worst of this very good special effects, the head on the tentacle, it also has like some of the best. Like on one hand, you have the doctor who has had his arms chopped off and then this thing springing out of the doctor. But then separately, you have Norris's head separating from his body and crawling down onto the floor and sprouting legs and running away.
Turning into the most terrifying spider ever captured in movie history.
Oh, absolutely. And then again, that's where Palmer has the best line. They hear this scuttling behind them, so you turn around and Palmer's like...
Yeah, they're torching the crap out of the thing that was lying on the table. And they don't even realize that the head had melted off and then sprouted wings and like crab eyes. While the head is like upside down.
Oh, yeah.
And then it like starts to scurry off behind them, which in and of itself is a great scene of them standing around the charred bodies and then singing the terrifying spider head just kind of crawling out the door behind them. But yeah, and then Palmer notices.
You gotta be fucking kidding.
Now it's time, because now MacReady has the idea. He's like, okay, every piece of the alien is an individual organism, which is a pretty good conceit, actually. So one by one, they decide to test everybody's blood by cutting their fingers in a nice, slow, well-paced, I think, buildup of tension, because you got the slight gore of cutting the fingers and putting the blood into little petri dishes, and then heating up the wire, and then putting the wire in the blood.
Yeah, and just the construction of the scene where you think it's just a dumb movie thing where they have the unknowns, the people who haven't been tested yet. They're all tied together on a couch. And when you're first watching it, you're thinking, that's so dumb. You would never actually do that. Because if one of them was the thing, they're all tied together. But they actually use that for a pretty terrific scene.
Oh, yeah. It's fantastic. And the fact that it's coming. I mean, they might not know it's coming, but we, as the audience, we know that this jump scare is coming, but it's still really right. Effective when it does.
Yeah, they all sell it.
Yeah. And Palmer actually has a really nice transformation scene. And I think actually before this is where MacReady shoots, I can't remember his name. The dog guy, yes. Yeah, because he's not fooling around. He has a standoff with Keith David, and then Keith David backs down, and that's when the dog guy who had grabbed his scalpel is going to go for MacReady, and MacReady just shoots him dead. Like, okay. Now we really know what's going on.
Yeah, there's a line a little bit later when they test the blood of even the dead folks, including the die guy who McCreed just killed. And I think it's Childs who, when the die guy's blood test turns out to be negative, Childs says, "Well, that makes you a murderer." And McCreed doesn't even acknowledge it. He's just like, "Next."
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I thought it was great that even though there were other, you know, as people get excluded, then they get untied off the couch. There's Knowles in particular is like, get me off the couch, you know. But still, I thought it was great after the very last test is Commander Gary and he's on the couch all tied up and he comes out just fine. And I'm sure I'll drop in the quote because it's pretty great. He gives this sort of slow, deliberate speech.
I know you gentlemen have been through a lot. And when you find the time, I'd rather not spend the rest of this winter tied to this fucking couch!
But before that, when they get to Palmer's blood, it is. So they've done a couple tests to that point, and they've been negative, so he puts the hot wire in the little petri dish of blood and it just kind of sizzles and nothing happens. And what's great about the jump scare that you reference is, at least on first viewing, I don't think you know what's going to happen when they get to a positive sample.
Oh no, and neither do they.
Right.
Because he's holding the petri dish in his hand. If you knew it was coming, you would not have that petri dish in your hand.
No.
But yeah, it's fantastic. Fantastic stuff.
So the blood just jumped away from the hot wire with a nice, nice monster scream.
Oh, yeah. It's just really, really effective. In fact, I think there's an entire series. Well, it's a TV series, but it's also a series of books that I think the first one is called Wire in the Blood. And I think it's actually a direct reference to this movie.
That's been on my list forever to watch. That's like a cop show, right?
Yeah, it's not bad.
Like a detective show?
Yeah, it's a detective and a psychologist. And yeah, it's good stuff.
Ah, that's a great reference then.
Yeah, I think so. Because I was trying to look, because when I was watching the show, I was like, well, where does this actually come from? And as best I could tell, it comes from The Thing. But
nice.
Yeah, anyway. So
speaking of awesome British things, the nurse from American Werewolf in London?
Yes.
She's in Captain America.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. I remember seeing that. So, is she good? I mean, is it fun?
She's not in it very much, but she has a nice little scene.
Excellent. Okay, so now we have, again, we're running out of people to test, although everybody now is supposed to be negative. So they go out to test Blair. And
Before. So the Palmer, so when they test Palmer's blood and it jumps away with the screech, he immediately erupts into this horrible thing with tentacles coming out of his head, and he's trying to crawl up into the ceiling. And all the while, the other two people, Childs and Eyebrows, are tied to the couch with them. So MacReady and Windows are trying to get their respective flamethrowers to burn Palmer, and the other two are just screaming bloody murder to cut them loose because they are now tied to the thing while it's changing into this horrible creature.
Oh, yeah, and MacReady's, you know, his flamethrower doesn't work, but even if it did at that point, a flamethrower doesn't seem like a very precision piece of armament, you know? Like, if you're tied to somebody that gets hit by a flamethrower burst, you're probably going to be having a little trouble.
I imagine that's probably the least of your concerns at that moment, though.
I think Keith David and the gang were playing a trick on John Carpenter because they weren't really familiar, I guess, with the flamethrower thing. So when they did the first flamethrower scene, I guess the next day they told Carpenter that Keith David couldn't actually come to the set because his face and hands were all burned, which, you know. Yeah, exactly. Which you know, I'm sure as a director, you'd be crapping yourself if you knew that was the case. Not to mention that, you know, this person is a person and could have actually been hurt.
And from all appearances, a giant person.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. So they go off to get Blair. And the first time, actually, let's get back. The first time they check on Blair is before Nahl's cuts McCready loose. But they check on him and have a little conversation through the little window hatch thing in the door of the little shed he's in. And in the direct sight line between you and Blair in the background is this noose that he's made.
Right.
Which is, it goes completely unaddressed the whole time, and it's fantastic.
He's super creepy. He's like, he's really calm. And he's like, come on, guys, just let me back in. I don't want to hurt anybody. Just let me back in. I don't want to be out here anymore.
So they're like, okay, and they close the door on him. But, well, they come out to check him now with intent, and they find out that he's gone. Well, he's made a tunnel underneath this thing, and he's building something down there. And what he's trying to build, this little spaceship-type thing he's trying to build, I thought looked pretty great because it's cobbled together through things that he would have found in the station, and it looks pretty good. You know, the metal pieces, you know, sort of Millennium Falcon shaped, but the metal pieces on top are all metal lockers, like you would throw your clothes in.
Yeah. They're locker doors.
Yeah. And there's like all sorts of like metal cans and things that are all welded together. I thought it was pretty impressive.
It reminded me of Chronicle. Did you ever see that movie?
I don't think so. Is that the superhero movie?
I'm sorry, not Chronicle. 8mm.
Oh, way back in the day. I don't remember a scene where they tried to build a spaceship in 8mm.
Ah, damn it. That's not the movie either. Is it 8mm, the Nicolas Cage movie?
Yeah. With the kiddie porn?
Yeah, that's not what I'm thinking of. Super 8.
Oh, Super 8. Okay, yeah. Okay, yeah, no, I haven't seen that movie, but I can see how that would be a little... Okay, that makes more sense. Yeah, I haven't seen Super 8, but the kid's trying to make their own movie?
Yeah, that's all you know about it?
Yeah, that's all. Well, I know there's some sort of monster on a train.
All right, I won't mention it any further.
Is it worth seeing?
I think, yeah, once.
Okay, so we'll put a pin in Super 8, and now we're
yes, and there's no reason to see 8mm.
Yeah, again, I haven't seen it since then, but yeah, it didn't. Is Chronicle good?
I love Chronicle. I think it's fantastic.
That's the superhero found footage movie?
Yes, yeah, and that's one of those. It's one of those movies where I have to look at the director and. Sort of like Take Shelter, where at the end of the movie, you're just like, holy crap, who is this? Who is this filmmaker? And what else have they done that I can absorb?
Didn't he write a ton of other movies or sell a ton of other scripts after Chronicle?
I hope so.
I want to say that he did. But again, I don't, I just, that's somehow in my head. I don't know how it got there, so God knows. Anyway, okay, so we have Blair now is, well, he's pretty clearly the thing, or a thing, because he's trying to build some sort of craft, and they're saying, well, where's he going to go? Like, anywhere out of here, because that's kind of the point. I mean, you know, you don't know the motives, if there is such a thing, of this creature.
Right. I mean, the only thing that makes sense as to why the creature would be trying to disguise itself instead of just murdering everybody is so that it can escape the Arctic.
And all it I mean, and you know at this point, it's all set up that if it escapes the Arctic, the world is doomed.
Right.
There's high stakes in this little game.
So I just looked it up while we were talking. Chronicle was written by Max Landis, son of John Landis.
Oh, okay. And
but it was directed by a dude named Josh Trank, who is going to be directing the Fantastic Four reboot.
Well, that's cool. So he's tunneling over the tool shed, and now he's been scavenging equipment to build this escape craft thing. And now Childs is missing, because they had left him on guard, and the station's power generator is destroyed. Well, not only destroyed, but gone. So at this point, MacReady is like, oh, he's trying to just freeze himself and stay on ice until some sort of rescue team comes, and then he can escape, meaning the thing. So we're left with...
Right, who everybody thinks is Childs now.
Yes. So we're left with MacReady, Gary, and Knowles, because Childs is missing, and they decide to dynamite this complex. And
yeah, which I didn't really quite follow. They wanted to keep it warm so the thing couldn't freeze, but that wasn't going to last long.
Well, exactly. That's the whole thing. You're right. I mean, you're only going to prevent everybody from freezing for a little bit. So while setting the explosives, though, Commander Gary is killed, and in my notes I put fingered to death by Blair.
It looked as uncomfortable as you made it sound.
Yeah. And then, of course, Knowles disappears. So at the at this point, you have MacReady setting charges, and we have the large monster, like the final boss fight in this movie.
Yeah, it was all right. I'm not mad at it.
No, it was fine. I thought it was probably really cool at the time, but again, the creature burrowing, under the ice and flipping up the floorboards as it went underneath. And that's been done so many times since, it's like, that wasn't really great effect. I thought it was interesting that the monster that came up from below knew enough to destroy the detonator, the little plunger thing.
Yeah, it's pretty smart.
So, but MacReady ends up triggering the blast with a one stick of dynamite, and the whole camp is burning. And MacReady's just kind of flopped up against the building, totally exhausted, when Childs appears. And Childs gives this explanation that he was lost in the storm while trying to find Blair. But at this point, who do we have left? We have Blair that's outstanding, but probably the thing that they blew up. Knowles, who is maybe one of the things that they blew up, but maybe has disappeared too. But the only two people that we know are left are MacReady and Childs. And
they have a bit of a nihilistic conversation because they both know that they're not making it out of there.
Yeah, and they also think one of them may still be the thing.
You the only one who made it?
Not the only one.
Did you kill it?
Where were you, Charles?
I thought I saw Blair. I went out after him. Got lost in the storm. Fire's got the temperature up all over the camp. Won't last long, though.
Neither will we.
How will we make it?
Maybe we should.
If you're worried about me.
If we've got any surprises for each other, I don't think we're in much shape to do anything about it.
Well, what do we do?
Why don't we just wait here for a little while? See what happens.
What did you think about that? Was Childs the thing?
There was an alternate ending where you see after Childs and MacReady have the conversation about how, well, if one of us is the thing, the other one's too tired to do anything about it anyway, so we might as well enjoy a drink. There's a scene where, an alternate ending, where you see one of the sled dogs that's walking away from camp turn around and look at the camp as it's burning, implying that that's the thing, and these guys aren't, and they're going to freeze to death, but it's off looking for another thing to transform into. So, yeah. So, I don't know. I mean, it seems like I don't have any kind of hope either way. I thought it was a great little, yeah, kind of a nihilistic ending.
Yeah, it was a great ending, because after that, where they're both kind of eyeballing each other, it's just cut to credits.
Yeah, yeah, it's fantastic. But this is where we can talk about how the movie was received. John Carpenter is a little bitter about the reception of the thing. He says he takes every failure hard, but the hardest failure of his whole career, he said, was the thing. It's like his whole career would have been different had this had been a big hit. But I guess the movie was hated by even science fiction fans, and they all piled on, so he was a little bitter.
I don't understand. This is such a fantastic movie.
Well, let's see. New York Times film reviewer Vincent Canby called it, quote, a foolish, depressing, overproduced movie that mixes horror with science fiction to make something that is fun is neither one thing or the other. Sometimes it looks like it's aspiring to be the quintessential moron movie of the 80s. Time Magazine's Richard Schinkel wrote, quote, designer Rob Bottin's work is novel and unforgettable, but since it exists in a near vacuum emotionally, it becomes too domineering dramatically and something of an exercise in abstract art. Washington Post.
They are on the wrong side of history.
Well, of course, yeah. Gary Arnold, Washington Post, calls the film a wretched excess. Newsweek's David Anson wrote, astonishingly, Carpenter blows it. There's a big difference between shock effects and suspense, and in sacrificing everything at the altar of gore, Carpenter sabotages the drama. The thing is so single-mindedly determined to keep you awake that it almost puts you to sleep.
They didn't see the same movie.
That's it. That's the whole thing, is they missed the point. It's like they were trying to watch it as a comedy or something. And, of course, this is where J. Scott, reviewer for the Globe and Mail, called the film a hell of an antidote to E.T.
That's a great way of saying it was awesome.
Yeah, well, exactly. Exactly. So, I can't recommend this movie enough. I think it's a fantastic movie.
Yeah, when I was texting you earlier, I was worried that this conversation was just going to turn into that old Chris Farley skit, where I'd be like, oh, you remember that? You remember that one scene? Yeah, that was awesome. Over and over and over again, because scene after scene after scene in this movie just hits the nail right on the head. I mean, the effects 30 years later now still stand up. You know, some of them look a little worse for the wear, but they fit with the entire aesthetic of the movie. It's great. It is still, even when you know what's coming next, it is still a terrifying experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I thought there was plenty of human interaction. You know, the whole thing between Blair and the dog guy in the beginning, the distrust, is fantastic. Anyway, I just, like I said, I think it's fantastic. And you're right, it's reviewers that didn't like it are on the wrong side of history. So anything else about the thing or anything else?
Roger Ebert only gave it 2.5 stars.
Yeah, I know. Sometimes he's wrong too. Feet of clay.
Yeah. He's wrong a lot, but at least he's usually very well written when he's wrong.
Yeah. And actually, you know, he was one that would go back and upgrade a rating if he felt it was warranted. But yeah, this is just, I think, if I remember correctly, my special effects history, Rob Bottin went a little crazy after this and had to take a bunch of time off.
Because of overwork?
Yeah, he was just working so hard. Because all the effects, everybody says, yeah, every effect that you see is Rob Bottin, which is pretty incredible. Anyway, yeah. So.
Yeah, one of the things I didn't appreciate about the prequel, the thing, have we talked about the title of the prequel?
No, I don't think so. Not specifically. Although it's ridiculous.
Do you know why it's called The Thing?
Why?
Because they, kept kicking around different titles, and they couldn't agree on anything that sounded good. So they were just like, all right, let's just call it The Thing.
Okay. I realize this is going to be sort of, silly to even say this out loud, but that is the wrong way to make that decision.
Yeah, that's probably indicative of why that movie went off the rails a little bit. Yeah. They had one really good jump scare in the beginning, which is great, but the creature effects, just even a movie made 30 years later, the creature effects weren't nearly as scary as the original.
If I remember correctly, there was some interesting like snow cat work in the movie. And they really got like into the spacecraft, right?
Yes.
But the problem is once you, in a movie like this, especially since it's so, you know, it's got a very stylized monster. Once you get into the spacecraft, aren't we just looking at Alien?
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. That's not great. By the way, well, I didn't know until we, Jason and I talked about Fifth Element, or I did the research for that, that Ian Holm, who plays, the priest in the Fifth Element, not only was he Bilbo Baggins in all the Peter Jackson movies, but he was Ash in Alien.
I don't remember him in Alien.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's not the hero of the movie, but hey, he was on the crew of the Alien. Or Alien, sorry. And I forget what the actual ship was called. It had a name. Yeah, that's going from that to Bilbo Baggins. And with a stop at crazy French science fiction movie in between. That's pretty great.
Wasn't he also Jack the Ripper in From Hell?
Oh, maybe he was, yeah. Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. He has a gigantic career as well, as far as credits. He has lots and lots of credits. Not Keith David amount, but close.
You've been listening to Not in a Creepy Way. As always, send feedback to show at notinacreepyway.com. Please subscribe to us on iTunes. Hey, write a review. Give us 5 stars. We'd appreciate it. You can also listen on Stitcher Radio. If you have a suggestion for a movie for us to talk about, send it to movie@notinacreepyway.com. We like feedback. We want to hear from you.